Good morning. Sorry for the delay, I couldn't find my Bible. Turns out it was in my bag where I had put it. And for the last few weeks, after abandoning Ecclesiastes for I think now the fifth time, I've been wandering around in the book of Esther. Wandering is probably an appropriate verb. I haven't really been able to latch on to very many coherent streams that I've followed with great benefit, but I've certainly enjoyed the experience, and unsurprisingly, Esther, therefore, is very fresh in my mind at this time. Now, if I look at a study Bible, this one, for example, I have a variety, it will tell me that Esther is a book that's all about courage, and I can see why they say that. Ultimately, I disagree, but certainly the courage of Esther herself and the courage of Mordecai, and the courage even of Queen Vashti, come to that, which should not go unnoticed, certainly form very strong, anecdotal, powerful plot developments within the book of Esther. Nonetheless, I don't see Esther as a study in courage, as the book per se. I see Esther as being a book that says, if you have power, how are you going to use it? I see that as the central theme, and the courage and the cowardice of the nobles that comes up within that storyline is all couched in that structure. It's about power and how you're going to use it. So interestingly, we're not going to gain any exhortational value from the book of Esther until we see ourselves as powerful people, as in a way kings and queens ourselves, which might sound a little high-minded, but I think it's as entirely appropriate. Spiritually speaking, the Bible speaks of us preparing to be kings and priests, and it's not for the purpose of self-glory that I would say that we should be able to see ourselves as people who have, by knowing the gospel and by knowing Christ, or by knowing Christ as well as we can, certainly have a huge responsibility to the world in general, to ourselves and to our community and to everyone on the planet Earth. And so Esther is a very good study then in saying, well, now that you are in a position of power, what exactly are you going to do with that power? And there's case studies basically in terrible abuses of that power, as we'll see from some of the characters, and case studies in magnificent applications of that power, as we'll see from others. And it's good to have control. We like to have, you know, without being controlling, which is a negative thing, we like to have control over our lives. I think it's a normal human feature to feel that you have some control, and not everything that's happening in your life is just sort of chaotic events landing on your plate. And we should probably recognize, take the trouble to recognize, that in this society we do have more freedom and we do have more control over our lives than some others enjoy, including our own brothers and sisters around the world. I'll make that a little bit more emphatic just with an example. It was less than a year ago I had the privilege to be in Myanmar, the new name for the country the British would once name Burma, and had the pleasure of being with our brothers and sisters there, and their life experience is not as free. They don't have control over simple elements of their own lives. I'll give you an example. In Myanmar, or Burma, your grades at school will determine your profession, and to some extent you might say, well, that's kind of similar here, particularly in terms of the subjects you may choose to study. What the not-so-subtle difference is, who chooses your profession? You do not choose your own profession. You go to school and you are schooled in various subjects, and depending on how well you do, you will be assigned a profession. So let's say Karen does superbly well and gets A's throughout. She will be assigned perhaps to be a medical doctor. Now, of course, knowing how Karen reacts to the sight of blood, this would be a complete disaster, but too bad, get over it, you're going to be a doctor. Not only are you going to be a doctor, but we've got a post for you, and it's in Chicago. So off you go, and you are sent to Chicago to work. And she may reply, but I have a husband in San Francisco. Well, yes, but said husband didn't do so well in school, sorry. I just like to pick on people now and again. And therefore, he's going to be a fruit picker in Central Valley. So he's going to be moved to Fresno. And that's where you're going to be. And unfortunately, it's fun to do this with hypotheticals, people sat in the room, but this is actually happening to our brothers and sisters. And that's just normal life. And okay, you'll see your spouse whenever you can, whenever you have enough money to perhaps travel a very long way. And if you're poor, then you're not going to see them very often. And that's the way it's going to be. And this is the 21st century, and this is how these people have to live. So it was a bit of a surprise to me, because I thought I knew a bit about, traveling around the world. But that was a shock to me, to discover that society was organized in that way. How grateful we should be, therefore, that we get to choose our professions with as much blood or as little blood in them as we might like, and also to live in proximity to our own spouses. There is an opportunity to apply for transfer, but only after a few years. So there's a young couple who are separated by about 3 hours, which is a big deal in Burma. And so they'll have to work for about 3 years before one can apply to a transfer to go to the same profession in the place where the other lives. And not only that, but there's a little bit of sort of financial encouragement required by the officials, as is normally the case. And unfortunately, they don't have enough money to pay that bribe. Myanmar is not officially corrupt. I guess nowhere is officially corrupt. And as a result, the corruption, the bribery shouldn't be happening. And the official was caught and fired. And then they gave the job to his wife, who does exactly the same thing, because it's for the same. So anyway, it's a puzzling scene. But it sounds like I'm rambling. I'm pointing that out just to say, be aware of our brothers and sisters and how much freedom we enjoy and how much control we have over our lives, because not everyone has that degree of control, even to choose their own profession or location of habitation. And so the Book of Esther, I see, is kind of similar in that it's all about, if you have power and control, exactly how are you going to use it? We read the first chapter, and we probably will need to have Bibles open at some point, so feel free to look it up. And I guess one of the principal plot developments is the deposing of Queen Vashti. And Vashti is deposed simply because she refuses to be treated like a possession to be paraded around to a group of drunken men, which seems like a reasonable objection. So she's put out for that reason. In other words, she's being put out, and here's where the Bible always has such wonderful irony. She's being put out because she's not sufficiently compliant, right? Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, I'm going to call him Xerxes because it's shorter. Xerxes wants a wife who is absolutely compliant, wants a queen who will do exactly what he says, and Vashti does not, so she's out, which by implication means the next queen coming by his intention, will be an extremely compliant woman. And God says, well, have Esther. And you can kind of hear God chuckling, because Esther is one of the most strong-minded and courageous humans to have appeared in the pages of Scripture, and absolutely does not at any time really accede to the wickedness in the regime of Xerxes. In fact, you will be familiar with this, I'm sure, the law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be repealed. You're familiar with that phrase and that reality. Maybe it's me that's just a little dense, but it was only on this year's visitation to the Book of Esther, I don't know if you realize this, that I actually realized that Esther actually repealed one of those. The law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be repealed, well, one of those laws was repealed by Esther. And that gives you an idea of how compliant she was. She repealed a law that could not be repealed. It was Haman's pogrom, of course, to destroy the Jews, and we know she reversed that, but it actually says that was written into the laws, the law of the Medes and Persians that cannot be repealed. And Esther said, no, let's change that. And it happened. So this is an extremely powerful and courageous character. So it's kind of ironic that Xerxes gets rid of Vashti because she's not compliant enough and ends up with Esther, who is 10 times the monster, as he would see it, that Vashti ever could have been. So I enjoy that. And the edict was issued because, as we read, because if the queen disobeys the king, so reasoned, probably correctly, the rather cowardly nobles, why there's going to be wives rebelling against husbands all the way through the land. And we can't have that. We have to have the men in control. So therefore, something horrible has to happen to Vashti that everyone can see to ensure that that doesn't happen. That was the cowardly reason behind why Vashti was deposed, as they explain themselves. And the king accepts that reasoning and does that. I think actually there is another occasion in the Bible which I find very fascinating where we see that applied. And it's not written, it's a little bit of speculation, but there is some evidence what I'm about to suggest. One of the best known stories in all of the Bible is the story of Samson and Delilah. Very well known, you'll have learned it in Sunday school because it's a great sort of Sunday school play to enact and such like. But what occurs to me over the last year or so, and I think there's microscopic evidence, but I'll show you, is the fact that Delilah was assassinated. And I don't think that's something that necessarily is broadly communicated. But I think the evidence is actually there. Let me start with the speculation. The speculation would be for exactly the same reason of Esther chapter 1. That's why I'm going on this little aside. Because the idea in Esther chapter 1 is, well, what precedent are we setting here? If you think about the Delilah situation, she was hired by political machinators to bring down a strong political figure, Samson, this renegade judge, as he would have been seen. So the precedent being set is, hey, ladies, you can actually, sell your man to his political enemies, and you will end up fabulously rich. I don't know if you remember how much money Delilah was promised. She was promised 1,100 pieces of silver from every single conspirator. We don't know how many conspirators there were, but that either way, that's going to add up to a fortune. But I'm sure that the men who were arranging this were thinking to themselves, hang on, if my wife gets the idea that she can sell me to my political enemies and live a fabulously wealthy life for the end of her days, this is a dreadful precedent to set. And therefore, they couldn't really allow Delilah to collect. Now, that's just speculation. The evidence that's actually in the scripture is tiny, obviously, otherwise we'd all know this since we were young, but the evidence is there because, and I will try not to go on a rant about chapter breaks, but chapter breaks are so unhelpful. At the end of the story of Samson Delilah, there's a chapter break which makes you stop reading, and that you shouldn't. The context in the very next verse, allow me to paraphrase, is this weird story of a man who said, he's talking to his mother, and he says, "Mother, you know that 1,100 pieces of silver that went missing? And you got so mad about it that you swore an oath. Well, mother," and I'll paraphrase here, he says, "I took it, but don't worry, I can give it back because I don't need it anymore." What do you think that's telling you? Those are the verses directly after the story of Samson Delilah. That man had a debt of 1,100 pieces of silver to pay, which is exactly the price, the very unusual number that Delilah was promised from each conspirator, and suddenly he didn't need to pay the debt anymore. Suddenly the debt had gone away. And of course, if the creditor is lying dead in an alley with a throat cut, you can imagine that's why the debt has gone away. So why do I say it? It allows us to see Delilah perhaps in maybe a more sympathetic light. I mean, the wickedness involved in the ensnaring of Samson is there, but the wickedness is in the political machinators behind the scenes. And if the guy in the next chapter is one of them, you'll realize that not all of them were Philistines, because he was an Israelite. So there were Israelites wanting to get rid of Samson as well as Philistines, which makes good sense when we realize how they've treated each other all through history. And it allows us to realize that Delilah doubtless was manipulated from start to finish, that she didn't have a choice about whether or not she would ensnare Samson. She was promised fabulous wealth and freedom, and in the end was killed. And even though Samson's life was short, I believe Delilah's life was even shorter. Anyway, that is somewhat of an aside, but it's driven by this same theory that we read in Esther chapter 1. We've got to make an example of the woman who's rebelled against the man, because otherwise we'll set a precedent that we won't be able to control and have control over these people that we want to control. In fact, the lack of respect is a source of rage for the king. Chapter 1 and verse 12. "When the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger." And that's part of this. There's some very fragile egos on display in the book of Esther, and there's one of them. And if you turn over to chapter 3 and verse 5, you'll see another one, and for the same reason. So Mordecai refuses to show respect and kneel down and pay honor to Haman. And so if we jump in at verse 5, "When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down before him or pay him honor, he was enraged. This is very common with the theme of Esther, the idea that you have these people who are powerful, and they use that power to feed their own egos. And when the ego is not actually appropriately stroked by those around them, then it results in rage. Let's look at one more example, chapter 7 and verse 7. I'm a little devoid of the... The king got up in a rage. Well, that's a little earlier, isn't it? Let's go into verse 8. Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" And he is furious. Okay? And the first time you read that, you think, oh, well, that's nice. At least he defends the honor of his wife. That's a good start. But when you read it again, you think, what is he actually enraged about? If you read the words carefully, he's not actually saying, my wife is being attacked, this is terrible. He's saying, it's being done in front of me. It's like, my presence doesn't matter. And he's actually defending his ego, not Esther. It's almost as if, oh, I'm happy for Esther to be sexually assaulted somewhere else where I don't know anything about it. Well, whatever, just a possession of mine. But it's the fact it's happening in front of him that causes him fury. So again, it's the ego which is at the center of his thoughts, not even the protection of his wife. So, back to chapter 1 where we were. Vashti is deposed and she is banished. And she is banished because she won't be controlled. Because the king doesn't get to make all the decisions. As I've said before, there is tremendous irony in the scriptures. And one of the most extraordinary things about this is that Xerxes the king then now has free reign to have all this control. There are 9 decisions made in the book of Esther following this, and he doesn't make any of them. He is absolutely controlled by everyone around him. He takes the advice of his nobles, of his counselors. He takes wicked advice from Haman. He takes righteous advice from Esther. He is absolutely, and I entitle this exhortation, the pawn who would be king. He wanted to be a king, but actually he was useless. He didn't make any decisions at all. In case you doubt me, let's look at the examples. Chapter 1 and verse 19. If it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree that can't be repealed, that Vashti should be banished. Fair enough. But this is Memucan who says this. Verse 21, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. So that wasn't him. And in the next chapter, chapter 2, it is his nobles who say, verse 3, well, summarize it. He says, let's have a beauty contest to choose the next queen, which is a pretty shallow idea. And the king says, yeah, that's great, let's do that. But again, it's not his idea. It's been proposed by someone else, and he's merely following along with it. And then again, in chapter 3 and verse 8, then Haman said to Xerxes, there's a certain people dispersed among your peoples, and it's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. Verse 9, let's wipe them out. That's the Jews he's talking about. And the king says, in verse 10, the king takes his signet ring and says basically, literally, verse 11, do with the people as you please. So Haman makes the decision, and the king just kind of goes along with it. Chapter 5 and verse 4, Esther suggests a banquet. The king goes along with it. Chapter 5 and verse 8, Esther suggests a second banquet, and the king goes along with it. Chapter 6, verses 7, and the king wants to honor Mordecai, and so he suggests, so the king says to Haman, well, you tell me what to do. I don't know how to do this. What's the best way to honor someone? And Haman, of course, thinking it's him that's going to get honored, says all these wonderful things, and they all happen to Mordecai, and that's sort of part of the comedy, I suppose. But once again, the point I'm trying to make is the king can't make up his own mind. So Haman has to do it for him. Haman has to desire it. Even the idea to hang Haman on his own gallows in chapter 7 comes from a man called Harbona, one of the nobles. That wasn't the king's idea. That was Harbona's idea. And then chapter 8, verse 3, Esther says, let's repeal this law that cannot be repealed. Let's not destroy the Jews. That's when she's come out with a very courageous advance to the king. And chapter 9, verse 13, she has another request to allow the Feast of Purim to continue. So all the decisions in the book of Esther, and the king doesn't make any of them, except one, right at the beginning, when he decides to parade Vashti around. That was the only decision he made. That didn't work out for him. So he got rid of her so he could make all the decisions, and then doesn't make any. There is tremendous irony in the scriptures, which we can appreciate, I think. So the whole point is, you have a royal position. Xerxes has a royal position, and then ultimately Esther has a royal position. Now that you have a royal position, whom will you serve with that position? And Haman and Xerxes have both shown that they will serve no one except themselves. Everything is done to augment their egos, to augment their glory. Remember how the book started, as Andy read. 6 months of the king displaying his glory. A six-month party just for the king to show off his wealth. Things move very slowly at this pace. I don't know if you realize, by the time he gets rid of Vashti and then Esther is brought in as the next queen, that isn't next week. 4 years have gone by. You can tell because it says the story starts in the third year of his reign and Esther comes along in the seventh year of his reign. So it took 4 years for this transposition to take place. But again, the king is just defending his own glory. So then let's look at the core, what gives us exhortation. Chapter 4 and verse 14. These are well-known words. Esther is now in position. The pogrom against the Jews has been issued. They are to be destroyed. And Mordecai, in verse 1 of chapter 4, while he sits in sackcloth and ashes, which I find is an attractive picture, sackcloth and ashes, because Haman has done everything possible to prance around in royal robes and display the king's signet ring wherever he goes because it got given to him. And Mordecai, when he learns of the destruction of God's people, sits in sackcloth and ashes. So you have this very humble man, or this man who doesn't have an ego. To sit around in sackcloth and ashes is not good for the ego. You don't look powerful. You don't look influential. You don't look grandiose. You look like a mess. You look like, you know, homeless and worse. And he's prepared to do that in order to reflect his sorrow at the potential destruction of God's people. And so what a contrast, therefore, between the sackcloth and ashes of Mordecai and the pomposity of Haman's displays. But Esther is in now a position of power. She instructs a servant to say to Mordecai, "All the king's officials and peoples of the royal provinces know that anyone who approaches the king without being summoned is put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the golden scepter. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king." Esther's words are reported to Mordecai, and he sends back the answer, "Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this." So Mordecai is saying, you now have royal power. Will you serve God's people with it? Unfortunately, it could cost you your life. And such is the righteousness and courage of Esther that she accepts that duty. Esther sends her reply, "Go, gather together all the Jews who are in the citadel of Susa and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Beautiful words there. Very commanding words of a woman who was prepared to throw away everything, including her own life, in order to use her position of royalty to serve God's people. So the contrast of egos is very clear there. And Mordecai, we could say, well, you know, that wasn't very brave of him sending the woman to do it, because, you know, it's easy for him to say from his armchair, well, why don't you go and risk your life? But Mordecai had already risked his own life. He had already refused to bow down or ever pay respect to Haman, which was commanded. And Haman was a murderous man and a man who had the ear of the king. So Mordecai had already shown comparable faith and comparable courage in recommending or asking Esther to make the risk that she did. And the idea that serving God's people with the influence that you have, the idea that that should be important, I think is underscored because it's mentioned in the very last book, a very last line of the entire book. Let me read, it's chapter 10 and verse 3. Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. End book. Okay. So the idea that it finishes on that underscored line, that this is a man who used his influence to serve God's people, is strengthened by the fact that it's the last line, indeed, of the book. And so then, exhortation comes to us. We have position. We have influence. We are articulate people. But how are we going to expend that articulation? How are we going to expend that influence? If I, as a scientist, start talking about creation, I will get mocked. I have been mocked. I continue to be mocked. Right? But that's a price that we have to pay, because I believe creation is true. And I believe science is true. I don't see a contradiction in the two. But some do. And so as a result, it is a position of prominence or a position of influence that I might hold. And it's influence and honor that I get that I must be prepared to throw away in order to serve God's people and say, no, God made this world. This world did not evolve out of a slime. God made it. How he made it, who knows, but he made it. And that's, I think, some of the exhortation that I'm just speaking for myself personally. You'll have to find your own interpretation. The lesson from Esther is clear. You have power. You are kings and queens. Goodness me, in Psalm 82, we're called gods. So how much easier is it in Esther to see we are called kings and queens, and we will be kings and priests on the earth. In Revelation 5, it says this. How are you spending your influence? Are you spending it? Are we spending it like Xerxes and Haman to build up a reputation of greatness in our community, a reputation of intelligence and honor amongst the people who are our friends that we know? Or will you spend it, if you need to spend it, to serve God's people? Esther and Mordecai were both prepared to spend their entire life, as indeed was the Lord Jesus Christ. And it's, whether it's coincidental or no, I don't know, but one of the best expressions of that comes in Romans chapter 15, which was our reading for this morning. So let's just read that just one more time to see this lovely phrase. It's right at the beginning. We who are strong ought to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Each of us should please his neighbor for his good, to build him up. For even Christ did not please himself, but, as it is written, the insults of those who insult you, presumably the Father, have fallen on me. For everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through endurance and the encouragement of the Scriptures we might have hope. Verse 8, for I tell you that Christ has become a servant of the Jews, could that be more the theme of Esther, on behalf of God's truth, to confirm the promises made to the patriarchs, so that the Gentiles may glorify God. So both Jews and Gentiles are served by Christ, the King, being prepared to become an object of ridicule and to prepared to die, to be destroyed in the service of God's people. So we are tasked by Mordecai and we are tasked by Esther to expend whatever prominence, whatever position we have for the influence and the service of God's people. And with that influence, we can stroke our own egos, as Ahasuerus and Haman did, or we can actually sacrifice it in the service of God. So that's what I see there in Esther chapter 1, and I'm enjoying Esther very much. I've been in it for several weeks, and I intend to be in it for several weeks more. So that would be my theme of encouragement this morning, and may God bless you to that end.